Thank you. What we're going to look at now is, in a lot of ways, a response to the sorts of things that Bill talked about in his last session. What do you do in the face of persecution? If you're the Huguenots in France and you're facing, you know, the crown coming down on you, how do you deal with that? You know, on one level, you could sit back and just accept the persecution and pray and so on. But if you're a nobleman in France and you have your own private army, that gives you some other options. So at what point, how do you do this? How do you even begin to think about this issue of when do you resist the crown? You know, Paul tells us in Romans 13, all the powers that are there by God's will. God has placed the governing authorities over you, so you should obey them. Well, what does that mean? How do we think about that when the government is starting to turn tyrannical? Now, it turns out that the Huguenots weren't the first Protestants who have to deal with this. It actually goes back to Luther. The Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, who was mentioned yesterday, Charles was an ardent Catholic and a reform-minded Catholic, but still very Catholic, and he, like most rulers of the day, did not believe it was possible to rule a religiously divided kingdom. And so he was very unhappy with the fact that Luther's ideas were spreading through the empire, that there were various territories within this confederation of states known as the Holy Roman Empire that were becoming heretical, that were adopting Lutheran ideas. So he was putting pressure on them to try to get them to return to Catholicism. They protested the pressure, by the way, which is why they became known as Protestants, means protesters. But along with that, they decided that, you know, the emperor was getting very close to threatening violence against them. They needed to develop a defensive league to try to protect themselves against the emperor. So a number of the Lutheran states got together. They created a league called the Schmalkaldic League. And then they contacted Luther and they said, you know, Luther, this is what we've done to protect the Reformation. We'd like your blessing on it. Luther said, not on your life. And they said, what do you mean? He said, well, Romans 13, we're supposed to obey the governing powers. That means you're supposed to obey the emperor. He said, but the emperor is going to bring us away from the gospel. Luther said, you have two choices. You either obey the emperor if what he's telling you is legitimate, or you engage in civil disobedience. You disobey and accept the consequences. You do not have a right of rebellion. So this got the League kind of confused because they formed basically to protect the Lutheran Reformation. So they did what you might expect them to do. They sent in the lawyers. And so a number of lawyers came to Luther and they said to him, Martin, under normal circumstances, and certainly in the context where Paul was writing, what you're saying about Romans 13 makes sense. Normally, that would be the right answer. But you are not taking into account the legal structure of the Holy Roman Empire. In the Holy Roman Empire, the emperor was elected by seven of the major princes. They were known as the electors. Since they elect the emperor, it is their duty to oversee the emperor. If the emperor does something illegal, if he breaks his word, any of these kinds of things, then it is not only the right, but it is the duty of the electors to resist him. So they talked it out, and Luther issued something known as the Torgau Memorandum in 1530 or 31, depending on exactly how you're dating things. Dates get kind of confusing in this period. But in the Torgau Memorandum, he said, if the lawyers are correct about this, you know, if this is in fact the constitution of the Holy Roman Empire, then it is legitimate for the princes to resist the emperor if he does something illegal or breaks his word. But there is no right of private resistance. Private individuals do not have the right to resist the government. Only the princes, only the so-called inferior or lesser magistrates. They have the right to lead resistance against the government because they are, in fact, among the governing powers that God has put into place. And so it is their duty, in a sense, to watch over, make sure that the people above them don't violate the law. Now, this is assuming that the lawyers are right about the Holy Roman Empire. Okay, so that's the Torgau Memorandum. That sets the stage for everything that follows. Okay, Calvin comes along. Calvin, as he is addressing this issue of resistance to the resistance to authorities that become tyrannical, follows Luther's lead. The lesser magistrates, the inferior magistrates, have the right to lead in resistance against a tyrannical ruler. Now, Calvin adds one other thing into the picture as well. This, again, goes back to Daniel Elazar, whom I mentioned in my first talk. There are, according to Elazar, there are three ways governments are formed. Conquest, organically, which leads you to the sort of aristocracies, government by elders and things like that, or covenant. And he says the only examples of covenantal government we have, the first example of it that we have in history is in Exodus. In Exodus, God establishes a covenant with his people. And the interesting thing about it is that that covenant, God gave them three opportunities to turn it down. He said to them three times, "Will you accept the terms of this covenant?" The people agreed three times. And that's what ratifies the covenant. Okay. So you have a covenant that's based on the consent of the governed. And this is found, like I said, this was in Exodus. Now, in Israel, of course, it fell apart. But the next time covenantal government comes up is in Calvin's Geneva. Because Calvin studied Exodus, and he got his ideas about government from Exodus. That government, if God established his government for Israel on the basis of a covenant, then human governments themselves must also be based on a covenant with the people. And that covenant is a sacred covenant before God, and the people have to consent to it. So this is a core idea that emerges in Calvinism. It's usually referred to as social contract theory, although that's really a misnomer. What it should be called is covenantal theory of government. Because there's a difference between covenant and contract. We'll get to that later. So Calvin adds this covenantal component into it, but he maintains from Luther this idea of the right of the lesser magistrates to resist when government turns tyrannical. Because when government turns tyrannical, they are violating the terms of that covenant. And other members of the covenantal government then have the right to lead in a resistance against it. Okay, so now we go to France. These are this is the thought world. These are the ideas that are floating around in France. In France, as we saw before, there's persecution going on. The Protestants are being burned alive in public squares, but you've got nobles who are converting to Protestantism, and with the nobles, you've got military forces that come along with them. Incidentally, the way the gospel spreads in France is the way it spreads historically in most places. It goes along natural social lines. In the case of the nobility, they're technically called patronage networks. But basically what happens is when one person converts, that person becomes a link that begins winning family members, clients, people both up and down the social scale from that person up through the entire network. That's the way evangelism tends to work best. And it certainly did that in France. But that means now that from the king's perspective, from Catherine de' Medici, the Queen Mother's perspective, while she is regent, she's looking out, and what she sees is a lot of the nobility, including members of the royal family, converting to Protestantism. And she begins to worry at this point that this could create a civil war. She is really desperately afraid of civil war because she wants to preserve the kingdom for her children. So she organizes the Colloquy of Poissy that was talked about before. Doesn't really work terribly well. Then in 1562, using modern styles of dating, she issues something called the Edict of January. The Edict of January is an edict that allows the Protestant nobility to worship in their own houses and under certain circumstances to allow worship to take place in the countryside, not so much in cities, unmolested. This is what the Edict of January says. Now, it's focused primarily on the nobility because, frankly, she doesn't care about the Huguenots in the city. You can do whatever you want to with them. But the nobility, we've got to keep them happy, because if they get mad, they're the ones who lead and who can create a civil war. Now, the Guise family that Bill talked about earlier, the Guise family were stridently anti-Protestant. And they were traveling back to their home in Lorraine, and they came across a barn in which there were a large number of people singing psalms. That's a dead giveaway, they're Protestants. Now, it was legal for them to do this. This was out in the countryside by the terms of the Edict of January. There was no problem with this. They, however, were not happy with this. So they surrounded the barn, set it on fire, and massacred everybody inside. When word spread of this, the Protestant nobles, particularly a number of the princes of the blood, members of the royal family, got very upset. And they ended up calling, mobilizing armies at the city of Orléans in France. When the Protestant armies began mobilizing, the royal armies began mobilizing. And that begins this interminable series of wars of religion. Okay. The basic pattern is this. The war breaks out. Depending on how well the Protestants do on the battlefield, a truce will eventually be called, in which the Protestants will have either more or fewer rights than they'd had after the last truce. The truce will last a little while, and someone, usually the Guise family, will break it, and another war will break out. This is the cycle, and it keeps repeating. Now, you'll notice, although it isn't entirely clear from what I just said about this, the justification for these wars of religion is resistance by the lesser magistrates. They're basing this on the ideas that Calvin articulated that were originally from Luther. Only now it's not the Holy Roman Empire, it's a generalized right of the lesser magistrates to lead resistance. This is going to continue. Eventually, Catherine de' Medici, this is exactly what Catherine was trying to avoid, eventually she will come up with what she thinks is a solution. The nominal head of the Protestant side, the highest-born noble on the Protestant side, is a young man by the name of Henry of Navarre. Henry, in dealing with these kinds of things, normally what you try to do is you come up with a diplomatic marriage. You get the two sides intermarrying with each other, and then they stop fighting, hopefully. That's the idea. So Henry is betrothed to Marguerite, Catherine's daughter, the sister of the King of France. They marry. And there's a truce, safe conduct, promised to all Protestants, things like that. They end up in Paris. And due to a number of, the Guises decide to assassinate one of the leaders despite the safe conduct. That creates a snowball effect of other things, and eventually a general massacre of the Protestants is ordered. That's the St. Bartholomew's Day massacres. The effect of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, there are a number of them. One of them is a lot of Protestants begin converting back to Catholicism because they say, how could God allow this to happen if he was really on our side? But the other thing that happens is that this kills off the main leadership, the people with diplomatic experience and things like that on the Protestant side, and the people who are left are basically the hotheads. And so this triggers, despite the effort to stop it, it triggers more wars of religion. At this point, you have a very sharp question that needs to be asked. When does a legitimate king turn into an illegitimate tyrant? In other words, when is violent resistance against the king legitimate? There are a lot of possible ways of answering this. But one of them is when the king starts slaughtering his own people for no good reason, that's a pretty good indication he's turned into a tyrant. So then the next question, and of course that's exactly what had just happened, the next question is, what do you do when a king turns into a tyrant? Most of the writers on this subject, which included Beza, it included Philippe de Plessis-Mouret, Mornay, number of others, François Hotman. Most of them are going to say resistance by the lesser magistrate is the right answer. However, some of them go the next step and say, under these circumstances, it's legitimate to assassinate the king, to engage in, well, they wouldn't call it regicide, they called it tyrannicide, killing off the tyrant. You see examples of this in the book of Judges. But it has to be done. Overall, the consensus is it's got to be done via the lesser magistrates, however you handle it. Well, the series of wars of religion continue. Henry III, long story here, I'm not going to go into it. Henry III got the ultra-Catholic side really mad at him, which drove Henry III into the arms of Henry of Navarre, who's now back to being a Protestant. Those two sides align, and actually the Catholics begin now arguing for tyrannicide. And ultimately, Henry III is assassinated. The irony here is that the Catholic assassin who kills Henry III did it because Henry was too close to the Protestants. By killing Henry III, he killed the last surviving member of the Valois family, the last surviving potential heir to the throne. And what that meant is it went to his nearest male relative, who happened to be Henry of Navarre, a Protestant. So by killing the king, because he's too close to the Protestants, he put a Protestant on the throne. You heard what happens from there. Henry becomes Henry IV. He's fighting a war. He basically consolidates control of pretty much all of France except the city of Paris. He is then reputed, probably incorrectly, to have said Paris is worth a mass, and converts to Catholicism to get Paris to agree to accept him as king. And he becomes king and issues the Edict of Nantes. So, 1598, the Edict of Nantes comes out. Now, I'm going to actually modify something Bill said a little bit. The Edict of Nantes, I would not actually describe as being about religious toleration. And the reason for that is we have to be careful about definitions of words. Toleration says, basically, we have different viewpoints on this subject. I may not like your viewpoint. I may disagree with it. I may think you are dead wrong. But I am not going to force you to change your views. We can live together even though we disagree. Okay, that's the essence of toleration for present purposes. The Edict of Nantes terms said, you know, the Huguenots have these different areas where, you know, they can meet and worship if the churches were in place by a certain date. They can continue to worship. There's a whole bunch of provisions for them. They're given fortified cities that they can use as cities of refuge in case the crown starts fighting against them again. There are all kinds of provisions that are made there. And the edict says that those provisions are in place until religious uniformity is reached in France. And that until clause is really important, because what it is saying is not we are going to accept the situation that Catholics and Protestants will live together forever. What they're saying is our goal is to reach religious agreement. Our goal is religious uniformity. What the Edict of Nantes is going to do is it's going to dictate the terms of the debate. We're going to do it with words. We are not going to do it with canons. Okay? We are going to stop fighting over religion physically, but we'll continue the battle of ideas until one side wins. The fact of the matter is neither side was interested in toleration. Both sides wanted to win all the marbles. And the Edict of Nantes was to regulate how that competition was going to be done. This analysis comes from an Italian historian named Mario Turchetti. Turchetti says that, you know, you've got two principles here. One of them is what he calls toleration. One of them is what we call concord. Toleration is, like I said, we can disagree and still live together. Concord says there is a minimal number of things we do need to agree with in order to live together. If we don't have these things, we can't do it. Okay. Now, the reason why I want to emphasize this point is I think it's an important one in American culture today. What we call tolerance in American culture is really concord. In other words, we have to agree that these categories don't matter. We have to agree that race doesn't matter. We have to agree that sex or gender or whatever term you're using currently doesn't matter. We have to agree that sexual orientation doesn't matter. We've got to agree that, you know, all of these different things. And as long as we agree that none of these things matter, we can get along, and that's toleration. Well, no, it isn't. It's concord. And Turchetti was the guy, the reason why I like doing this with the Edict of Nantes is Turchetti was the guy who really crystallized this in my own mind to see what was going on. We've actually inverted the use of the word tolerance at this point. Okay. But in any event, that's the conditions with the Edict of Nantes. When Henry IV is assassinated by Ravaillac, and by the way, it's worth noting that the assassins of both Henry III and Henry IV were, at one point, both of them were Catholic clergymen. Henry III's assassin was a priest. Ravaillac was an ex-monk. Once they assassinate Henry III, his young son Louis XIII comes to the throne. Louis XIII was not terribly interested in most of the mechanics of ruling. A lot of the actual work of running the kingdom was in the hands of his prime minister. They called him first minister, we would say prime minister. A cardinal in the Catholic Church by the name of Armand de Plessis, Comte de Richelieu. He's usually just called Cardinal Richelieu. Those of you who've seen The Three Musketeers, he's the bad guy in that. Not really fair to him, I need to say, but the thing that's significant about Richelieu for our purposes is that Richelieu believed that the needs of the king and the central monarchy superseded all other claims to rights or privileges or anything else in the society. Nobody could claim special rights against the monarchy because the needs of the monarch were more important than the needs of any group within the society. Okay. That's a principle he called raison d'état, usually translated to reason of state. What it really means is that the monarchy's needs override everybody else's. Now, what that meant is, among other things, Richelieu had to ride herd over a lot of groups in French society that were claiming special privileges. So he works against the nobility and tries to reel them in. Provincial governors, all kinds of things. Actually, even though he's a cardinal in the Catholic Church, he gets involved in the 30 Years' War on the side of the Protestants against the Catholic Emperor because there were political considerations that were more important for him to side with the Protestants rather than the Catholic Emperor. He's very even-handed about how he applies this principle. But he also applies it against the Huguenots. Because the Huguenots say, by the terms of the Edict of Nantes, our rights and privileges are irrevocable. They cannot be taken away from us. Richelieu says, you have those rights and privileges only as long as the king allows you to have them. Because the king's needs and the centralization of power is more important than anything else, and you can't claim that the Edict of Nantes gives you those rights. The Huguenots say basically, oh yes, we can. Richelieu engineers a provocation which results in the Huguenots taking up arms and withdrawing to their fortified cities. Richelieu leads the French army out and reduces those cities, takes them one after another, the last one being La Rochelle. And then he leaves the Huguenots alone. Because what he did there is he reduced the Huguenots to direct dependence on the crown. They could no longer rely on their fortified cities to protect them. And they knew that their rights, their privileges, and their protection depended on their loyalty to the king. And so they became among France's most loyal subjects to the crown. They had no choice in the matter. So that's actually a violation of both the letter and the spirit of the Edict of Nantes. When Louis XIII dies in 1643, Louis XIV takes over. Louis XIV is the ultimate expression of absolutism. He believed, I mean, he actually said at one point, L'État, c'est moi. I am the state. The state, it's me. You know, when you're talking about this, the state, the Kingdom of France, I'm it. That's it. He believed that he should have all of the power in the kingdom. Now, it needs to be said, Louis was a brilliant, brilliant political leader and thinker. Made some blunders, certainly, but he was a brilliant thinker, and he was able actually to pull this off pretty well. The thing that really annoyed Louis, for our purposes, is the fact that there was a religious minority in the country that said, that disagreed with him on religion, and furthermore, that said that essentially, if you follow through on the argument, Louis was going to end up in hell because he was not a true believer. And Louis resented that. And Louis believed that the very existence of a religious minority in the kingdom called into question his position as an absolute ruler. So Louis begins persecuting the Protestants, violating once again the letter and the spirit of the Edict of Nantes. The Dragonnades, sending these dragoons into Protestant villages, basically telling them, move into Protestant homes and do as much damage to property and, if need be, persons as possible. There will be no repercussions. Basically, if a dragoon moved into your house, you could count on being bankrupted in less than a week. They would destroy you. And all you had to do to get rid of the dragoon was convert to Catholicism. It got so bad that when word started spreading of these dragonnades, that people would, you know, villages, people in villages would hurriedly, they'd hear dragoons were coming, they'd hurriedly go to the Catholic Church to abjure, just to keep them from destroying their livelihood and everything else. There were other provisions as well. Huguenots, for example, were forbidden from leaving the kingdom, except pastors. Pastors could go. But everybody else was required to stay in the kingdom. They were forbidden from emigrating. And so many people converted back to Catholicism because of the Dragonnades and other kinds of persecution that Louis declared that the terms of the Edict of Nantes were fulfilled. There were no more Protestants left in the kingdom. And he revoked it in 1685. Now, of course, there were a couple of million Protestants left there, and they got the last laugh. If you want to put it that way, when Protestantism was legalized and, during the Revolution and came out of the woodwork. For our purposes, though, I want to note that what was happening with the Huguenots in France was known elsewhere. Because however much they may be forbidden from emigrating, they did. If they could get out of the country, they did. And remember what I told you. Who are the Huguenots? They tend to be literate, you know, well-educated, frequently from highly skilled backgrounds, you know, merchants, bankers, skilled craftsmen, things like this. These are the people you're driving out of your kingdom. They enrich the Netherlands, they enrich Germany, they enrich England, Scotland, and so on. They're going to all these other areas and bringing their skills and money with them. So that's going to hurt France. But the other way it's going to hurt France is it's going to spread word of what Louis XIV is doing. And it's going to spread that word, again, for our purposes here, particularly to England. And people don't usually make this connection, but it's really critically important. What's happened in England? Well, while all of this stuff is going on in France in the 17th century, England's got its own series of problems. There is a conflict between the King of England, who is also the King of Scotland at this point, and the Church of the Christians, the Presbyterians in Edinburgh, basically, that turns into rioting, that turns into a war. The English King had to go to Parliament to raise money for the war, but Parliament was in the hands of Puritans, who actually were kind of siding with the Scots at this point. One thing leads to another, you get the English Civil War. The king is caught, he is deposed, he is executed. You get a period called the Commonwealth under Oliver Cromwell. This is, by the way, also the context in which the Westminster Assembly is meeting. When Cromwell dies, his son tries to take over, but he's really not a very effective ruler. Now, I should note, by the way, during this period, there are two things that I mentioned before that come back. One of them is Calvinist contract theory or covenantal theories of government. That's promoted by the Puritans. Okay, the Puritans have been promoting covenantal theories of government all along because they're Calvinists. In fact, one of the places you see this is in New England. The Mayflower Compact, a compact is another name for a covenant. It's a covenantal structured document. Fundamental Orders of Connecticut, same thing. It's structured as a covenant. So covenantal political theory is alive and well among the Puritans, and even the English Civil War is justified by the same kinds of resistance theory led by the lesser magistrates, in this case Parliament, that were advocated by Calvin and that were pushed by the Huguenots. Even the execution of Charles I is tyrannicide in their mind, justified by the political arguments of the Huguenots in the wake of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacres. So the Huguenot political theory is heavily influencing England at this point. Okay? However, as I said, Cromwell dies, his son takes over, not very good. The army ends up inviting Charles's sons to come back to England. Charles's sons grew up in exile in Louis the 14th's court. They come back, Charles steps in, all of the covenantal theories of government are essentially quashed at this point. We're back to a divine right monarchy. Charles II at least has the grace to be a Protestant. When he dies, he's succeeded by his younger brother, James, who is Catholic. Now, in England, they've had a long series of wars with Spain and tension with France. They saw Catholicism as being the equivalent of tyranny. They are also watching what Louis XIV, the guy in whose court James was raised, they're watching Louis XIV persecute Protestants. They see in 1685 Louis making Protestantism illegal. And they are looking at James, who is busy trying to circumvent the law and appointing Catholics into high positions in the government. And they say, this is not good at all. It is the effect of the persecution of the Huguenots in France that leads the English to conclude that having a Catholic king is going to mean that they're moving toward tyranny. And so when James has his heir in 1688, Parliament acts. They depose James. They invite William and Mary. Mary is James's daughter. They invite them in from the Netherlands to come in and change the dynasty. James is driven out of England. This is called the Glorious Revolution. Okay. Glorious Revolution happens because the Edict of Nantes was revoked. The two of them have to be linked together. Now, here's the next step. In 1688, you have the Glorious Revolution. The following year, 1689, a guy by the name of John Locke, who grew up as a Puritan and has now moved into a kind of liberal Protestantism, Locke pens his two treatises on government. What does he say in the two treatises? First of all, he takes Calvin's covenantal theory of government and presents a secularized version of it in contract theory. He takes God out of the equation in a lot of ways and says that government exists as a contract between the government and the people. If the government violates the terms of the contract, the people have a right to revoke the contract. Now, this is a bit more radical than what we've seen. Up to this point, it's always been lesser magistrates. Locke is following George Buchanan, an earlier Scottish writer, in arguing that the people have a right to revolt. So the people have a right to revoke the contract with the government. Okay. Further, Locke says that this contract consists of the government protecting the people's unalienable rights, which are in Locke, life, liberty, and property. That's not original to Locke. It turns out all three of those are found in medieval theologians as unalienable rights. Locke knew that. They're unalienable because they predate human government. They were given by God to Adam and Eve in the garden. God gave them life before government came along. Government does not have the authority to arbitrarily take someone's life. God gave Adam and Eve liberty in the garden. And by the way, liberty is not the same as freedom. Liberty actually means the right to pursue a good and virtuous life. It's freedom for something rather than freedom from restraint. Freedom from restraint was in this period called license. There was no unalienable right to license, only the liberty to pursue a good life. Okay. The third one was property. Where do you get property in the Garden of Eden? God tells Adam and Eve, tend the garden, take care of the trees, and you can eat the fruit that they produce. You are literally entitled to the fruit of your labor. If you work for something, you put part of yourself into it, and therefore you own it. All of these precede human government. Therefore, government cannot arbitrarily deprive you of any of them. If the government does, the people have the right to revoke the contract and establish a new one with a new government that will protect their rights. So this was written up in a lot of ways. The two treatises were written up as a way of justifying what was done in the Glorious Revolution. In getting rid of King James II, they were defending the people's unalienable rights. In this case, the right to liberty, because James, as a Catholic who grew up in Louis XIV's court, was assumed to be a tyrant. Locke's theories then crossed the Atlantic and influenced heavily one Thomas Jefferson, who tells us that in the Declaration of Independence that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. He changes property to pursuit of happiness. That's a whole other discussion. But the thing to notice here is that all of these steps, as we look back, you know, we can anchor them in Luther in the Torgau Memorandum. We can see covenantal theory and an extension of the lesser magistrate argument more generally than just the Holy Roman Empire. We can see that in Calvin. We move it over to France, where these ideas of resistance theory, when it's legitimate to resist the government and how you can legitimately resist the government, those develop further in France. They influence England with the Puritan Revolution and then are sharpened some more with some other things added by Locke in the Glorious Revolution. And then they end up over here in justifying our revolution. All of these things are tied together. And the Huguenots are a critical component in all of this, that people, generally speaking, even people who I would say should know better, completely ignore. Because, again, without the wars of religion, you don't get this evolution, this development of these ideas of resistance. You don't get these core ideas that end up influencing England, that end up influencing Locke and ultimately Jefferson. So even in our own political history, when we talk about the Huguenots, even our own political history owes a great deal to them. Now, we can debate or all we want about whether or not their arguments were correct, whether or not, from a Christian perspective, they were justified in engaging in these kinds of wars of self-defense, as they would describe them. That ends up being a sort of a separate question. But all of these things do develop in this theological context where they're asking the question, what does God demand of us? What does God expect of us in this situation? How can we rightly respond so that we don't disobey God, so that God is not dishonored and his gospel is not extinguished? That's really the essence of why all of this happens. And again, we think of this in terms of sort of secular revolution in America, you know, or in England, even with the Glorious Revolution. It's a lot more than that. There's a lot of very serious political theology going on here in the midst of all of this. And I would suggest that it is an active question today for Christians in many parts of the world. How does one deal with a government that is increasingly stepping on unalienable rights, that is increasingly pressuring Christians, that is actively persecuting Christians? How do we respond? How should we respond? We tend to think of a pacifistic response in the wake of Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. But there are other traditions out there that have spent a great deal of time thinking about these issues, wrestling with these issues, that have come up with some different conclusions. And I think that it pays to be aware of that and to take into account their arguments, not that will necessarily come to the same conclusions they do, but we need to be aware of these and take these things into account as we assess how we as Christians respond when we are under pressure and how we should think about the Christians overseas as they are under pressure, how they should respond, and what our responsibilities to them are. Okay, thank you.